You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 12, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, why labor organizing should be a civil right, an op-ed, and a new book co-authored by Richard Collenberg, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. He'll be with us to explain to us why labor organizing should be a civil right. Also on the program today, horrible event in Afghanistan. Not terribly inconsistent with all the horrible events that apparently take place in Afghanistan, but at least 16 civilians killed by at least one soldier who went on a rampage. The DOJ stops the Texas voter ID law in its tracks. NYPD apparently not just surveilling casually Occupy Wall Street, but going out actively harassing its participants. IRS may start to crack down on some of these shadow groups or shadow funders of shadow groups. We'll see about that. Former head of the Israeli Mossad says Iran is perfectly rational. All that and more today on today's program, folks. This just in, the Department of Justice will not pre-clear a photo voter ID law signed by Texas Governor Rick Perry because it will have a greater impact on Hispanic voters. There are some states that under the Civil Rights Act, when they change their voting laws, must be cleared by the Department of Justice because of their history of discrimination against minorities, their history of making it harder for minorities to vote. And in Texas, they came up with another one of these voter ID laws. The Department of Justice ran some data. Hispanic registered voters in Texas were either 46.5% or 120% more likely than the average voter to lack a form of photo ID. This is according to data the state of Texas submitted to the Department of Justice. The first data set that 6.3% of Hispanic registered voters lacked photo ID compared to 4.3% of the general pool of registered voters. The second data set said that 10.8% of Hispanic registered voters lacked ID compared to 4.9% of registered voters. So in other words, by the state's own admission, or at least their own data, their voter ID law discriminates, is a de facto discrimination of Hispanic voters. The Department of Justice said, in conclusion, the state has not met its burden of proving that when compared to the benchmark, the proposed requirement will not have a retrogressive effect or that any specific features of the proposed law will prevent or mitigate that retrogression. Texas had preemptively sued Attorney General Eric Holder back in January for not pre-clearing this law. Didn't work. The Lone Star State had claimed at that time that it did not collect racial and ethnic data on its citizens in an attempt to facilitate a colorblind electoral process. Guess that didn't work out so well. The DOJ, Texas, argued that the Department of Justice had to let their law go into effect because the Civil Rights Division had pre-cleared a similar Georgia law during the Bush administration, but apparently that law was approved by political appointees over the objection of career staffers in the Department of Justice. So one tiny, 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 but relevant, highly relevant example of the difference between a Bush administration Department of Justice and an Obama administration. Not a huge difference, but certainly a relevant one. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Richard Kahlenberg about why labor organizing should be a civil right. We'll be right back after this.
I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way, the way of slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah. And you wasn't the light. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Richard Kahlenberg. He is the co-author of both an op-ed in the New York Times and the forthcoming book, Why Labor Organizing Should Be a Civil Right. He co-authored that with Moshe Marvit. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's... I want to start with, and one thing I think that people don't understand in this country is how really restricted in many respects people are in terms of their right to unionize and also to protest or to strike in a union. And much of that comes from the Taft-Hartley law, as far as I can tell, and I guess subsequent revisions. Can you speak to that?
Sure. We're really an international outlier on this country, on this issue. If you look at Freedom House, which is an organization that evaluates freedom throughout the world on a number of different criteria, they rate us as having a less free country with respect to labor organizing than 41 other nations, all our competitors. And the major problem in this country is that if you try to organize a union, the employer is very likely to fire you. And that's technically illegal under the labor laws, but the penalties are so incredibly weak that a firm that wants to prevent unionizing will just pay the penalty as kind of a cost of doing business. So in this country, there really isn't the genuine freedom to join a labor union, which is why we've seen this enormous collapse in the strength of organized labor. We used to have 35% of the private sector workers in unions, and today it's down to less than 7%.
And so has that been a change in the law, or is that how always existed? We've just had other laws that have basically been rolled back that that allow for the full exercise of this right to join a union to protest in the context of being in the union.
Right. Well, as you point out, you know, the, in 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act did weaken our labor laws, but the problem of the penalty, the weak penalties, has always been there. What's changed over time is that the culture in this country has allowed corporations to exploit weaknesses in the law. You know, throughout the 1940s and 1950s, even into the 60s, there was a general consensus in this country that people have the right to organize, and that labor unions were a credible way of keeping peace in the workforce by allowing employees and employers to come together at the bargaining table and hash out their differences. But then, beginning in the 70s and the 80s, really with Ronald Reagan, you saw a change in the culture where corporations started hiring union busting consultants who would come in and figure out every way to prevent unions from organizing. So it's really a combination of laws that have been fairly weak all along, but then a change in the culture that has been exploited in recent years, making it much more difficult to organize a union.
And that was sort of that wasn't just a project by Ronald Reagan when he was president. I mean, he really started that shortly after, I guess, being president of a union. He then went on. He was hired by I think it was Boulware, right, at General Electric, and then sort of crisscrossed the country, teaching people to be suspicious of unions.
Well, that's right. I mean, the irony, of course, is that Ronald Reagan recognized the value of unions in other countries, right? And he was a strong proponent of the solidarity movement in Poland, and correctly so. I mean, that's one of the great chapters in the history in opposition to communism, and the way workers banded together and overthrew an autocratic regime in Poland. That was, and Reagan recognized that. But then in this country, he had a very different view, and really did a lot to set back the rights of workers to organize in this country.
Before we get into sort of how you construct how this the right to organizing would be a civil right, I want to just sort of point out, you know, sort of some deficiencies in the rights that we have as Americans to practice protest in the context of a union. One piece that's already been written about your op-ed by Eric Alterman, he cites Josh Idelson in These Times, that political groups have every right to boycott advertisers and funders who support a cause of which they disapprove. But labor unions don't have that same right to act against supporters of the employers who seek to break their strike. In other words, they don't have the same rights to sort of boycott or organize against suppliers, or they can't do secondary strikes. Explain that to people, because I don't think there's a full realization of just how much your rights get curtailed if you're doing it under the auspices of a union.
Well, that's correct. That was part of the Taft-Hartley reform in 1947. They did away with the so-called secondary boycott, where a union could join with another union someplace else and come together to strike against a supplier or a secondary party. And that had an enormous impact in reducing the power of labor unions to address their rights in this country. The Taft-Hartley Act, by the way, I mean, if you look at the politics of this, Republicans had a very narrow window in which to act, and they saw that you know, with the New Deal, they were really worried that the Democratic Party was going to become the majority, kind of a permanent majority in this country, and they knew exactly where to apply the legal pressure and pass this legislation to outlaw the secondary boycott and other tools that labor might use, and it had the desired effect.
Is there any other example in American political life where your involvement, your membership in a group like that would curtail your rights in such a way? I mean, I'm trying, you know, to sort of think of an analogy, and I can't quite come up with one.
I don't know of any other example. I think this is it's really extraordinary.
Has anyone ever challenged that part of the Taft-Hartley amendment? Now, this amended the National Labor Relations Act in 47. It essentially it outlawed sort of organized general strikes by unions, right?
That's right.
Has anybody ever challenged the constitutionality of this?
I haven't followed the constitutional question, but I know that in 1964, 65, 66, in that era, there was an attempt to repeal provisions of Taft-Hartley, which, you know, Johnson had a majority in both houses of Congress, and this seemed like a good time to move forward on labor law reform. But labor efforts to change the labor laws in this country have been extremely difficult. Every time you have a Democratic president and a majority in both houses of Congress, there have been attempts at labor law reform. Four times under Johnson, under Carter, under Clinton, and then under Obama. And all four have failed, which is why we're proposing kind of a fresh approach to, rather than simply changing labor law reform or engaging in labor law reform, which some Americans see as kind of special interest legislation. We really think this should become a matter of civil rights, that you should have a basic right to try to organize a union and not be fired or discriminated against on that basis.
All right. So walk us through, how would that work in a sort of a practical sense in the context of legislation that there's, statutes that already exist, and how would they be amended to reach that goal?
Well, that's right. So what we're talking about is taking the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as it's been amended, and right now that act provides that you can't fire someone or otherwise discipline them, discriminate on the basis of race, color, sex, religion, and national origin. And we're suggesting that we should add an additional category, that you shouldn't be fired on the basis of seeking union membership. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which provides those protections, would be amended to include people who are simply trying to, you know, organize a union, become members of the middle class, that they shouldn't be fired for that reason.
Now, this isn't particularly unprecedented. I mean, we have labor laws, or I mean, we have civil rights, I should say, that cover instances and in workplaces that are not simply a function of what we see in terms of Title VII. I mean, if you're pregnant, you can't be discriminated against because of prior criminal conviction in some instances, or whistleblowing. I mean, there are other instances, right, where your whatever would where you're protected from being fired because of those contexts.
That's right, and that's a very important point, because some people make the argument the Civil Rights Act should only apply to, you know, so-called immutable characteristics, something you can't change, like your race or national origin. And the point that we're trying to make in proposing the labor union addition is that there are all sorts of actions that are also protected, like if you call out your employer for engaging in environmental degradation or violating health and safety laws. There are whistleblower statutes. The issue of religion, which is in the original Civil Rights Act points out the issue of volition. So if I'm a Christian and I convert to Islam, there's a choice involved in that, and yet that choice is protected. That you can't, an employer can't say, well, he chose to convert to Islam, therefore it's okay for me to discriminate against him. So the Civil Rights Act has been understood to apply not only to immutable characteristics, but also to protected actions, and that's where the idea of trying to exercise your right to join a union should be included under that rubric.
And we've seen, instances like where you have industries that are protected not only by the National Labor Relations Act, but subsequent, like the Railway Labor Act, which actually has been somewhat in the news with the FAA authorization. But that workers in those industries that are covered by that, which I believe is some of the major transportation and sort of shipping businesses, they tend to be more unionized, which is one indication of the implications of having laws that make it easier for people to exercise what you would say is a civil right.
That's right. The strength of the laws matters a great deal. So in the case of the Railway Labor Act, if an employer is firing people and engaging in unfair labor practices, there's a remedy available where they can go in and seek an injunction immediately and get that stopped. So the law makes a difference, and the law also creates a culture in our society. So the Civil Rights Act, when it was passed, helped create a culture in which employers now recognize that it is wrong and indeed shameful to engage in explicit racial discrimination. That same set of laws and culture does not exist with respect to labor organizing. And in fact, employers try to pick out and fire the ringleaders of a labor organizing movement precisely to send a message to the other employees that they ought to be scared if they ought not to engage in labor organizing. So the statute makes a big difference. And if you look at what has happened since Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, when he was in Memphis trying to organize sanitation workers, we've seen really important progress on civil rights for African Americans and Latinos and others. Not enough progress, but things are headed in the right direction with a strong law. With respect to labor, we're seeing the opposite. With a weak law since 68, we've seen a big decline in labor and with that, an enormous increase in inequality. That's a point I guess I'd like to emphasize that, there are lots of things that are being suggested to address what President Obama has called the defining issue of our time, the rising inequality. There's the Buffett rule on taxes. Some people are proposing better spending on education, those sorts of things, all of which I support. But if we want to have a really big impact on economic inequality, we have to address the collapse of organized labor in this country. And it seems to me that recognizing the civil right to unionize would have an important impact.
In terms of the practical implications, you mentioned that the Railway Labor Act allows for a worker to force an injunction against a corporation that is engaging in unfair labor practices. In the context of industries that are not covered under the Railway Labor Act, it's the opposite, where corporations have the ability to file injunctive relief against the union that is engaging in policies or engaging in activities that go outside of the that are found illegal under Taft-Hartley, But the union, when you fire a worker, like you said at the beginning of this interview, their relief comes 7 or 8, 10 months down the road. And is this just a tiny fine, which is just a cost of doing business? So let me ask you this just finally. Obviously, this is not a game plan that we're going to be able to execute now. And going forward, why do you think it'll be easier at the end, in the long run, to get the, I guess it would be Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to be amended, if that's what you're proposing? Why would that be easier ultimately than any other type of reform?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because as I mentioned earlier, we've tried labor law reform 4 times and it hasn't worked, even with Democratic majorities in Congress. The main distinctions, to my mind, between the civil rights approach and the labor law reform approach is that the civil rights approach, first off, fits better into our country's emphasis on individual rights. Now, I'm someone who values on solidarity.
I'm sorry.
And in this case,
I'm sorry.
I think we can...
Richard, you cut out for there a minute. So you were just saying you're someone who values.
Who values solidarity, the solidarity, people coming together in the labor movement to advance their collective interests. I think that's an important value. But at the same time, in this country, the fact is that we're culturally all about individual rights. And by amending the Civil Rights Act, we better comport with that fundamental idea that we ought to protect individual rights. And so the notion would be, if you are an individual out there and you're part of an effort to try to organize a union, you shouldn't be fired for exercising that right. The second distinction is that civil rights are rightly recognized as a moral issue. So people who are in school, learning about the history of this country, they understand the moral values that infused the civil rights movement. Whereas labor law reform in the past has been seen as special interest legislation that doesn't really excite people the way that civil rights does. And so to my mind, for both of those reasons, it will be far easier to pass efforts to improve the strength of the unions in this country by emphasizing the civil rights approach as opposed to the traditional labor law reform approach.
And I would add to that I think it would increase people's awareness of just how curtailed your rights become when you are doing it under the auspices of a union as opposed to any other endeavor. Because, you know, when you're not allowed to show your support because for someone else who is striking or, involved in some type of action against a company or a corporation or an industry simply because you're a union member, that to me just seems bizarre, frankly. And I'm not sure enough people are aware of that.
That's right. Hopefully these discussions will bring those points out. And, we've seen in Wisconsin and Ohio, when the fundamental right to collective bargaining was attacked by Republican governors in the public sector context, that Americans have responded and they realize that there is this fundamental right that exists, and it may be that now finally we're seeing people energized on this issue, given the conservative overreach.
I hope you're right. Richard Kallenberg, senior editor, senior fellow at Century Foundation, author, co-author of Why Labor Organizing Should Be a Civil Right. Appreciate your time today.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me, Sam.
We got to take a break, folks. When we come back, this story from Afghanistan. A horrible story. And Well, a couple other stories there. Apparently in California, anyways, there's going to be less cancer in your Coke or Pepsi. That's always nice. We'll be right back after this. So I believe it was yesterday, it was reported that a U.S. Army sergeant killed at least 16 civilians, nine of whom were children, in a part of southern Afghanistan. The story, there are conflicting reports as to how many people were involved in this. The official story is that this one Army sergeant, who was part of a specific unit which functioned to organize local police units and track down Taliban in the southern part of Afghanistan, left his base in the middle of the night, I guess traveled a mile, and then started banging on doors in a local village and just shooting up people, and then grabbed them once they were dead and attempted to burn a bunch of them. You're talking about nine children, four of them girls younger than six. He has been deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq at least one other time in the past. There's obviously mixed information. There are reports that multiple witnesses, though not the preponderance of witnesses, at least according to the New York Times and the AP, said that they saw other soldiers. Now, it's unclear whether or not they saw other soldiers who came in after the fact or during it, but it does seem sort of stretch the imagination slightly that this guy was able to at least to kill people and then attempt to gather them together to burn them. It's unclear. But one of the most disturbing things that struck me in reading this story, because we're going to hear how this lone gunman was crazy, how he lost control of himself, how this is not indicative of anything. New York Times reports the killings came 2 days after an episode in the Kapisa province in eastern Afghanistan, in which NATO helicopters, apparently hunting Taliban insurgents, fired on civilians, killing four and wounding another three. This is ongoing in Afghanistan. And the idea that it's one lone gunman who did this, one soldier who went crazy who did this, is the problem, is completely understating and underselling what the problem is. The problem is that we are constantly, on a weekly if not daily basis, killing civilians in this country. And nobody can really explain why. What it is that we're supposed to be doing there. You know, we had that moment where the country could rejoice, those who wanted to, in the killing of Osama bin Laden. Well, where's the dividends for that? If we're going to... It's bad enough that we have to reduce this country in terms of its moral stature from where it was when it could actually try crimes against humanity to now where we just simply assassinate people, or targeted killing, I should say. But why couldn't we use that event as a reason to get out of a quagmire where all we seem to be doing is treading water at the expense of innocent civilians? It's really just a horrible, horrible shame. And hopefully we will get out of that country sooner rather than later. But you know, for those who suggest that there's a presidential candidate who is going to be more apt to get out of Afghanistan, and that candidate is Mitt Romney, I would tend to disagree. We just, in this country, don't have enough popular desire that is manifested anyways to stop killing civilians. That's just the reality. And, you know, when the voice of reason, when it comes to attacking another country, comes from the Mossad, the Israeli version of, I guess, the CIA, but CIA plus, maybe. The former head of Mossad, Meir Dagan, was interviewed for CBS 60 Minutes. And he said, as he said in the past, that he doesn't think Iran is an existential threat to the Israelis. The regime in Iran is a very rational one.
Hey, what happened?
I thought they were completely out of control. I thought they were these screaming mullahs who simply would get a nuclear weapon at all costs and then just immediately launch it as soon as it came off the printing presses. No doubt they are considering all the implications of their actions. They will have to pay dearly, and I think Iranians at this point in time are very careful on the project. Talking about just whether or not they're even going to maintain their program of developing the capacity to develop a nuclear weapon. You know, there's a lot of countries that actually develop this capacity, A, to create nuclear energy for themselves, which, you know, is dubious, all things considered, tomorrow being the Fukushima anniversary. And we'll have a guest talk about that tomorrow. But also, some of these countries, I think somewhere around 40 of them around the world, use it as a deterrent. And it would be irrational for Iran to not think they need a deterrent from the possibility of an American invasion or attack. Or, for that matter, an Israeli invasion or attack. This coming on the heels of reports, unconfirmed reports, that the Obama administration promised the Israeli administration, Bibi, that we will sell them bunker busters and a capacity to provide for them a capacity for Israel to refuel their jets after the November election. In other words, please don't attack Iran now. That would be really politically uncomfortable for us. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. I will read in the coming days the emails you've sent for those of you who are freeloaders and can afford to pay for the show. So if you can't afford to pay for the members' show, I understand. But those of you who are freeloaders and not becoming members, we've gotten some emails. Love to see more. And we will go into those sometime later in the week. My favorite one is the one where someone's asking whether or not they're going to telling me they're contemplating becoming a member, but they want to make sure that I don't discuss my better half, Nikki, in the better half of the program because they have a crush on me. And I'll tell you, I'm not sure, we'll come up with a number, but for a certain amount of members, I will never talk about my wife again on this program. And if we get even a larger multiple, I don't know, it would probably, I would say somewhere probably well into the hundreds, I will leave my family, both my child and my wife, and just move into this office. But we probably have to put a fairly high bar on there. something that could make it possible for me to build a shower in here. Just go into the bathroom and give myself sponge baths. Coming up in the better half of the program, some interesting bills requiring adding requirements for men to get prescriptions for Viagra. Less cancer in Coke and Pepsi in California. Interesting story about Elections USA, whatever that group is, that third way group, where your funding is going towards. All that and more in the better half of the program. You can become a member, support the lesser half of the program, as well as get the extra info and fun in the better half for $10 a month at majority.fm. Become a majority reporter today. Now, do it. Also, you can support the show by buying your junk through our Amazon link. You go to majority.fm, click support the show, click on the link, bookmark it, buy all your stuff from there. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. See you in the better half.